Hello and welcome to another month and another episode of Cloud Security Podcast. This month, we're talking about cloud native security. Yes, for the month of April 2022, we're going to be talking about cloud native security in support for the KubeCon happening next month in Europe. We are the media partner, and if you haven't checked out, please check out the CNCF, which is the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, which is doing awesome work in promoting open source cloud native products and cloud native security products. So today I had William Morgan from Buoyant, and we spoke about service mesh. It is probably one of the most requested topic on the podcast so far. If you have just on a side note, if you do have a topic you wanted us to cover, please feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn or just go on the website. There's an email there. Hit us up and I would be happy to cover an episode on the topic as well. So service mesh, we spoke about what is it? Why are there so many kinds of service mesh? Who should look at this from an operation perspective? What should you consider from a security perspective? And also, if you are in a big enterprise, what are probably some of the things from a team responsibility and team skill set perspective you should look at for service mesh? Shout out to the folks who were asking a lot of questions on the live stream. If you haven't joined a live stream, feel free to drop in. We normally run them at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, US, or 8 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time on our LinkedIn, YouTube, and Twitter platforms. And it is every weekend. Basically, if you go on the website, if you go on the YouTube channel, you'll probably see it. I highly recommend it. If you want to come on to live stream, it's a party out there. I look forward to seeing you on another live stream. But for the moment, enjoy this episode with William Morgan talking about service mesh. And while you're there, feel free to drop us a rating or review on iTunes or Spotify. We really appreciate you spreading the word and helping us get in front of more people so that they discover us and I selfishly get to help more people as well and find out more topics that I can cover for all of you. So thank you so much for this. I hope you have an awesome weekend and I'll talk to you next weekend about cloud native security. Peace. Stream. How are you going?
Good, very good. How are you?
Good. I am super excited about this conversation. This is the first one in a series of cloud native conversations we're going to have on the podcast. So I'm really looking forward to this. I guess to kick things off, we are talking all things service. So maybe before we kind of get into the whole service mesh thing, a little bit about yourself. I guess just a bit about your professional journey, where you are today, and how you kind of, what was your path to that place?
Yeah. So today I'm fully immersed in everything service mesh, but of course I didn't start out that way. So I kind of got into the cloud native world a little bit circuitously. I was an engineer at Twitter in the semi-early days, 2010, for a couple of years after that. And Twitter at that point was going through this big microservices transformation, and a lot of what Twitter learned in the process ended up being useful to other companies. And Twitter was kind of early in that journey, echoes of everything that's done in kind of the cloud native transformation at other companies. So that was my introduction to it. Twitter at the time, of course, didn't have Kubernetes, didn't containers, didn't have any of that stuff, but the patterns were there. And so when we started Buoyant and started working on Linkerd, which is our service mesh, we were basing it on what we had seen be successful in that infrastructure transformation. So that's the short story.
Yeah. Also, so Twitter, Buoyant, and kind of service mesh. This is before pre-service mesh kind of a thing. That's kind of how the idea came about, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it was a really interesting time and kind of a weird idea, and people still struggle with it, but it's here to stay. There's
definitely no escape. I mean, we have a whole month and a conference running on cloud native, so there is definitely no escape on service mesh potentially for people who are working in that space. This has probably been one of the most requested topic for me around service mesh, because in terms of what is service mesh for people who do not know, because maybe they are working in the cloud native space but still may not have heard about service mesh. So how do you describe service mesh?
Yeah, so the way I describe it, there's kind of two ways. There's first, what does it do? And then there's, how does it work? And the, how does it work is kind of interesting and kind of unique. But I think before you can understand that, you have to understand, what does it do? So what the service mesh does is it gives you a set of features that traditionally you had to build into your application. And it gives them to you at the platform level, which means you don't have to build them into your application anymore. And we usually bucket those features into three buckets. There's a set of features around reliability, set of features around observability, and then there's a set of features around security. And the security one is kind of where things, I think, that may be the most interesting. But all of those features are delivered to you in a way that is kind of decoupled from the application. And it fits really nicely into the Kubernetes world, because Kubernetes, one of the beauties of its design was that it has a very well-scoped design, right? So it says, this is what we're going to do. And beyond this, Kubernetes is not going to do that. And that leaves space for other implementations, right? So Kubernetes, Kelsey Hightower said it's a platform for building platforms. I think that's to its credit. That's part of why it was so successful. So it stops at a certain layer and the service mesh can kind of take over from there on. So that's what it does.
Oh, right. So it's kind of like you have the, to quote Kelsey Hightower, then platform to build platform. And on top of that, to manage that platform that you've built on top of Kubernetes, that's that mesh.
I wouldn't say that it manages Kubernetes, though. It's kind of, it fits in this intermediate space between what the application is doing and what Kubernetes is doing. So very good at, hey, I've got 50 machines and I've got 100 applications. Distribute those applications to those machines. And I don't really care about the details. Just make it work, right? Whereas the application, of course, is like, here's a business logic that I need. I need to move dollars from this user to this user through this bank. And in between these things, how do I encrypt communication between the different components of my application, which are running on the cluster, but talking to each other over the network? Or what do I do when one part of my application is starting to fail and I need to retry requests? Right. So it's not business logic. It's platform logic, but it's not the kind of thing that Kubernetes itself handles. So that's where the service mesh is.
Here, the more it sounds like networking, and I'm going fundamental.
Yeah. I think you can definitely consider it as a type of networking. It's just networking traditionally has been like you establish a TCP connection and we will get you data from A to B. And that's kind of what networking gives you. Whereas this is more, well, it's not just about getting data from A to B. We need to do it in a way that's secure, and we need to do it in a way that's reliable, and we need to do it in a way where you can tell exactly what's going on. So it's kind of advanced networking.
Right. And to your point, I guess it probably is the advantage of being decoupled also makes it like, imagine you can put it where you want to, take it out when you don't need it, kind of comes with the flexibility of it as well.
Yeah, that's right. And you can upgrade it kind of independently from the application and things like that. And that's where kind of the magic comes in, because all of these things you can do in the application itself, right? You can do retries, you can do TLS, you can do all that stuff in application code. It's just not related to your business logic. Right. So you kind of, it's nicer to pull it out. You can do it through libraries. So that's nice, right? You could have a library that does this stuff and then you kind of just link it. But then if you want to change the way it works, you've got to rebuild the application, redeploy it and stuff like that. Magic of the service mesh is because it's at the platform layer, you have this kind of barrier in between the two. And it all works thanks to the magic of Kubernetes and containers and this idea of sidecar containers, which is the really transformative thing. I think that's really, if Kubernetes has brought anything to the world, it's this idea of sidecar containers. I don't think people really appreciate that, just how powerful that model is.
Yeah, I think we're definitely going to get into the sidecar model as well. I know I compared it to networking, and to your point, reliability, observability, security, and having that decoupled sidecar, there's a lot of moving parts there. But I'm also kind of wondering that people listening to who would have heard that word networking when I said beginning, and they're, well, haven't we figured out networking ages ago? Why do we need this new model? Yeah. So what's your response to that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And I think that's exactly the question you need every time some new piece of technology kind of enters the world is, what has changed that suddenly makes this relevant? And for the service mesh, what changed is ultimately the move to cloud computing. Right. What cloud computing means is it means a couple of things. One, it often means, not always, but it often means that you are running your code now on hardware that you don't own and on a network infrastructure that you don't own. Right. Mm-hmm. So suddenly you used to have a lot of control, right? You used to literally own the wires between the machines, and you own the machines and everything was in the data center and you had the key. Right. Now you have no guarantees. Right. So this is all running and it's being shared with other people that you don't know about. Right. It's running. So that's one thing. The other thing is just the model that we expect from a software, the requirements we place on software has actually changed, right? 10 years ago, 20 years ago, maybe even less, 5 years ago, you could have planned downtime. It was okay. You'd say, okay, the website's going down from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Sunday. But nowadays, you can't really do that, right? You expect software to be available all the time. And you used to be able to say, okay, well, once something's in the data center, we're not really going to do security within there. We're going to have a firewall that's going to protect everything. Then once you're in the data center, everything's kind of trusted, right? And we can't really do that anymore. So things have changed, and that's why the requirements we place, not only on software, but on the network have changed.
Right. So since your point that in cloud computing, what are some of the use cases for this then? Because sounds more, if I have Kubernetes, there's clearly a use case there. I guess, is it only Kubernetes though? If I'm just using containers, I've got a swarm of containers, maybe not Docker swarm, but just I've got plenty of Docker containers to work with. Would that be a use case? Because I'm just trying to pin, okay, I understand the complexity is a lot more different in cloud. However, what's the use case here? Going back to what you were saying, questioning whether the use case that I may think of is the right use case or not. What are some of the example use case that people can think of would be applicable for service mesh?
Yeah. So the way I would think about it, kind of the broader, the broad change is we're doing cloud computing, right? And and that doesn't just mean, I kind of described it as you're running on other people's applications, but or on other people's hardware. But that's not really the more fundamental thing is that you're treating compute and you're treating network as utilities, right? That's the fun one. There's a whole show we could do about this, right? Within cloud compute, but that's a big change and it's here and there's no going back. Within cloud computing, Kubernetes is one implementation and containers is one implementation, right? And traditionally, it's been like, how do you do cloud computing, Kubernetes and containers and microservices is kind of the basic recipe. That's an implementation detail, right? But that's a very common pattern. Twitter did not do that. Twitter was earlier than that. That's the model that many companies are adopting. And within there, then a service mesh becomes feasible for you. It doesn't, philosophically, a service mesh does not require Kubernetes. Linkerd does. Our service, we tie it to that because A, it makes life easier for us. And B, the service mesh, one of the things it does is it distributes lots of tiny proxies everywhere. So you end up with 10,000 little proxies. And then you can kind of do that effect. In other kind of paradigms, that's a big operational burden. And then the trade-off is not quite worth it. So it kind of, Linkerd came to fruition in a world, in an environment like Kubernetes where we had containers so we could isolate the proxies and you didn't really care what language they were written in. You didn't care what libraries, it was just a container, right? Yeah. And you had Kubernetes to do the orchestration where you could say, hey, deploy 10,000 proxies, stick one next to every application instance, and Kubernetes would do that without it being an insane thing to do.
Right, because you could do that at scale at that point in time.
Yeah. You can write some YAML and it just does that. As opposed to when I was running the stuff that we ran in the early days of Twitter, you got three machines and you memorize our names because they were your three machines. You wanted to deploy 100 proxies. You were writing the Chef or Ansible or Terraform or whatever it is to do.
Yep, 100%. I think fortunately, I think a lot of people still remember a lot of numbers, a lot of IPs. That shit was very common to remember IPs.
Yeah, that's right. So that's another thing that's changed, right? There's this idea of treat your machines as cattle, not as pets. Gruesome the description. But the idea is like you don't care about individual machines. If the machine dies, you move on. Kubernetes just takes care of it.
Right? Yeah. Okay, cool. So maybe another way to, because another question that would come in, okay, cool. I understand the use cases now, but what about deployment? Because there's a whole conversation. I mean, we kind of touched on the sidecar method as well, where what are the different kinds of deployments that people can think of? Because I almost feel is, because it sounds like it's meant for more cloud first. I don't know if an enterprise can actually go into a service mesh. Maybe that's a good question to ask first. Is service mesh only for, if it's only for cloud compute, as you kind of mentioned, if an enterprise is doing a lift and shift of just something which is super monolith, no decoupling of any kind, and they move that into cloud, probably not a best use case for service mesh. Would that be right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the way that the service mesh works is it basically intercepts the communication that's happening between microservices, right? So if your application is a monolith, service mesh can't do a whole lot. I mean, it can do something, but it can't do a whole lot for you, right? That communication isn't there. Similarly, if your application is doing batch processing and it's all offline, well, we can do something there, but a lot of the value is in the kind of the real-time aspect. So yeah, there's definitely cases where it's not super useful. I'll say there are plenty of enterprises who are using Linkerd in production, are talking about it. We've got an awesome talk with one that I really like from Microsoft at this upcoming KubeCon for Xbox Cloud, the cloud service. It's a huge enterprise. Parts of Microsoft that don't use Kubernetes, don't use Linkerd, right? So, but there's certainly plenty of enterprises that are using it.
Right, but they're obviously using it for use cases which are more cloud compute, cloud native kind of use cases. Yeah, perfect. And so maybe that's a good segue into the whole different kinds of deployment model then. So I understand my use case now, cloud native. Mm-hmm. What are some of the deployment models for service mesh? What do you recommend? Because I think it's kind of me inching towards, because now we started the foundation for service mesh. Mm-hmm. Now that's me inching towards the things you mentioned about reliability, observability, security. So taking that security pillar as well, what are some of the deployment models? And maybe let's start with that. What are some of the different deployment models for service mesh?
Yeah, so this is the magic of Kubernetes, which is that if you can make your application run on Kubernetes, we can deploy a service mesh and it'll work for it, right? So it's not there's 20 different models. We just fit to the standard. And Kubernetes provides this type of deployment, that type of daemon sets and replica sets and deployments and Argo rollouts. And there's all sorts of options. But because we can take advantage of the sidecar and basically stick a container that has Linkerd's data plane proxy next inside every pod, it doesn't matter what the model is. That pod will be there, it'll have the proxy, and Linkerd will start mediating that communication. So it's a really elegant.
So why not have it as part of the build versus as a side container, as what sidecar?
Yeah, so if you this is kind of a library versus sidecar, right? right? So you can have it as part of the build. You could have it as a library. And in fact, that's the model that we were used to from Twitter. The problem then is you've coupled it with your application, right? So if you want to update the service mesh, you then have to rebuild or relink and redeploy that. If it's a library, it typically has to be written in the same language, or it has to have some kind of, you know, binary compatibility, at least. It gives you a lot of constraints to doing that. Right. Whereas in the sidecar model, it acts as a proxy and your application doesn't need to know anything about it. Right. And if you need to update it, you can update it without updating the application. Right. And that ends up being really important because typically there's two different teams that do this, right? With the platform team and its application team. And the application team, you don't really want them thinking about this stuff, right? They're supposed to be building business logic. On the platform, they own this stuff and you don't really want them, you know, having to worry about the details of the application. So the fact that there's this boundary between the application container and the sidecar container. And Kubernetes gives you this mechanism of sticking them together at runtime. It's runtime binding. You get this really nice division of responsibilities.
So that's a good point, because that kind of makes me understand a bit more of the reason why decoupling is preferred as well, because technically if you make it part of the library, you're tightly coupling it with the application that you're building. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, while you would hope that our organization there's a separate platform team managing, say, your point Kubernetes deployment or the platform deployment itself, it's easy for them to update policies for security, reliability, and observability as well, without affecting the actual thing, I guess.
No, that's absolutely right. In a lot of ways, the service mesh isn't about solving technical problems so much as it's about solving social problems, right? Yeah. Like, there are these two teams and they have different responsibilities, and to the extent that they're tied together and they have to interact, that's fine, but you're slowing them down, right? And you want them to be decoupled. There's different things they're aiming for.
Right. And maybe this is a good one to follow up with this one then, because I hear so many service meshes. And I know you and I have spoken about this offline, but it is, I think, the number of questions I was getting about why are there so many service meshes? Why are there so many service meshes? Why can't there just be one, I guess, with the question?
Yeah, I don't know. That's annoying. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple things going on. I think one thing is they're kind of cool. It's a cool piece of technology. So there's an attraction to building them. Right. So a service mesh, there's a control plane, there's a data plane, right? And the control plane is what you as the operator interact with. And the data plane is the proxies, right? And those proxies are actually not fun to build. Those are hard, really hard to build. But there's some generic proxies you can use. Envoy is a good choice. And so if you have solved that problem, and it's just, we'll just write a little control plane on top of Envoy. It's one of those things where it's nerd bait. You're like, that'll be cool. I can orchestrate those things. And then once you're 6 months into it, you're like, oh crap, what have I done? It's terrible. But it's just, so I think that's one component. I think another component is there was one service mesh that was very, very popular and had a whole lot of marketing, but it wasn't good. And so it got everyone excited, and then it kind of left this empty feeling. And so people,
I think you're referring to the Google one, but I'm with you on that one, because I've definitely heard. So I guess to your point then, the service mesh as a principle, the principle is the same across the board, whichever service mesh you end up using. The reason why you want it, and maybe the underlying piece is different. Is that how you're saying? That's where it's different kinds of service mesh?
Yep. The implementations are different. The components are different. The feature sets are different. But the broad ideas.
Right. So maybe let's talk about securing then, I guess, the security aspect of it. What are some of the security considerations people need to have when, say, we might have, I guess, we actually do have a lot of cloud security architects and security architects who listen to the podcast, and from their perspective, they're reviewing an application. Yeah. And to your point, there's a sidecar approach, they have service meshes, they need to kind of think, where does one even start questioning what should they be looking at? Because traditional networking would just mean that, hey, there's an IP, and there's a few other things to consider. What do you kind of go down the path of reviewing from a security perspective? What should they be looking for?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And the way I would think about this is there's two aspects to it. There's what is the security enhancements that a service mesh brings? And there's also what are the security vulnerabilities that the service mesh introduces? Right? Because you can't have one without the other. You can't introduce something that's going to have all these fancy features and then find out that actually it's got this big vulnerability in it, right? Yeah. You have to look at both sides. I'll say, kind of just to go back for a moment to that point about the organizational dynamics, one of the very earliest experiences that we had with Linkerd was we had a very large company say, hey, guess what? And this was the project was very young. We didn't know if it was going to take off. We didn't know anything. We had a very large company say, hey, we're deploying Linkerd everywhere. And we're like, really? Why? And they're like, well, because we want mutual TLS, right? We want MTLS. And we're like, really? And you want to use Linkerd? Why don't you just do it in the application? And they're like, well, there's 10,000 different teams of developers, and they all have their own product managers, and they have their all own agendas. And if we were to go to each of them and say, hey, we need you to implement MTLS, and we need you to like make that one of your priorities, it would take us a decade to do this. Or we can just install Linkerd, right? And we get MTLS everywhere, right? So that was the first sign where I was like, okay, I see. It's really less about the technology and it's more about this kind of organizational dynamic. So getting back to your question about security, if we start with the feature set, we'll start with the fun stuff, right? And then we'll talk about the pain. The fun stuff, I think the big driver for Linkerd is mutual TLS. Right. That's the thing where it's like, okay, if we want encryption in transit, there's a couple ways of getting that, but this is one easy way. And it also gives us a lot of other nice features. It gives us workload identity, and it gives us some primitives on top of which we can start building really rich policies around who's allowed to talk to whom. It does it all in this really principled way, and it does it all in a way that is zero trust compatible. And that's really interesting, right? Because that's the model. If you are kind of advanced security professional, that's the model that you are kind of weighing most of the time. That's the model you're kind of weighing yourself against. Does this move me towards zero trust or not? So that's what Linkerd gives you. And that's really powerful.
Right. Because I mean, so to your point then, if mutual TLS is just probably the first component people thinking of, kind of goes back to what you were saying about networking fundamental, where that's been in the networking fundamental for a long time, where if you have two people talking to each other, how do you encrypt that? Mutual TLS was one of the obvious ways to go down this path. Is that the only thing kind of that makes that people should be looking out for in a service mesh from a security perspective? Actually, funny enough, there's a question as well from Roxanne. What security capability service can provide that without that we could not easily achieve? Oh, so for mutual TLS, for best keys, how best keys should be managed in an enterprise?
Yeah, great. Those are great questions. So the problem with TLS is that it's a huge, everything sounds great until you think about what's going to happen with the keys, and then it becomes a huge maintenance. It becomes insane. And this has prevented people from adopting MTLS in the past. I actually wrote a long article, if you search for like Kubernetes Engineer's Guide to MTLS, where I talk about this like for pages and pages, because I also had to learn it myself. But I'll give you the short story here. And then if you want some bedtime reading, just Google search for Kubernetes MTLS Engineer Guide or something. The one thing that Linkerd can do, which is really, really nice, and again, it's because of the magic of Kubernetes, we can handle the vast majority of the key management problems for you because we're doing it in this very consistent, very uniform domain, right? Because Linkerd is there and it's a pod, it's a container in every pod that you have added to the mesh. And because we know exactly how those pods work, we wrote those proxies and we know exactly, we can design exactly how they're going to issue CSRs and get the how identity is prevention, all that. The vast majority, 95% of the key management stuff is taken care of for you. So the moment you install Linkerd, we even turn it on by default. The moment you install Linkerd on your cluster and you mesh an application, you have mutual TLS automatically for all meshed pod-to-pod communication. Now, the 5% that we can't do that you have to think about is TLS has this kind of hierarchical identity, right? And at the root of the hierarchy is this trust anchor or this trust root. And you have to decide what you're going to do with that, right? We'll generate it for you if you want, or you can provide it. But you need to have a strategy for that trust. Is that you make that live for 30 years and you lock it in a safe somewhere? Or do you have it short-lived and you rotate that thing? So at the pod level, we're rotating every certificate every 24 hours. That's configurable. By default, we rotate everything 24 hours. And then at the cluster level, there's another layer and we rotate that at another interval. But then that trust anchor, that's kind of up to you. So that's the slightly complicated answer.
Such a good point. So to your point about the hierarchy then, so to, I guess, to Roxanne as well, is it, so in an enterprise, they most likely have that trust certificate authority. They would have figured that part out. So the layer below that is basically having, Linkerd is open source as well. Yeah. So something like Linkerd or whichever other open source they want to go for. But I think the idea would be you should be able to manage the relationship. So to your point, rotation of the keys should happen automatically if it's possible across the board, across your pods, across your platform layer as well. That's probably one feature they should look for. What else should they look for to kind of make a right decision for a mutual TLS kind of a conversation?
Well, I think that's the big one for MTLS. Once you have that, then at least with Linkerd, you basically have MTLS, you have workload identity, and you have that stuff. It becomes a little more complicated if you're in a multi-cluster situation and you want those clusters to talk to each other. So Linkerd will do cross-cluster communication. It'll use the same MTLS stuff. It hardens it. And so those clusters could be running on different clouds. That connection could be over the open internet. That's all fine. We don't make any assumptions about the underlying network topology. But in that case, both clusters have to have the same trust, right? So the hierarchical model. And there you have to worry about, okay, well, I have this intermediate issuer attached to the cluster. How often am I rotating? Like that cluster, if I lose those credentials, someone steals them, can someone impersonate anything on that cluster? Maybe. How long? What's the lifetime there? Is that a year? Is that a month? Is that a week? So there's nuances. There's nuances there.
And she's got a follow-up question, which is a good one as well. Does service mesh help with east to west network security? Does it use EBF, eBPF?
Yeah, so two different questions. So does it help with east west network security? So that is basically what we describe the service mesh is doing, is east west communication, right? North south is we have ingress coming into the cluster, and then that's north, I guess, and then south is when we talk to a database or something, and east west is the communication with the cluster. So that's the security that the service mesh is really good at. Especially we'll integrate with any ingress, you know, so Kubernetes has this notion of an ingress and we'll integrate, and that's what's doing, that's what's handling the north-south stuff. And we'll integrate with it and we'll allow you to mesh it and apply MTLS within the cluster. So you can have this end-to-end encrypted communication, but we just integrate.
So to your point, the service mesh is actually providing the east to west. It can integrate with north to south, but essentially at the essence of it, if, for anyone else listening as well, it is essentially east to west security.
Right. Now, so the second question is, does the service mesh use eBPF? And the answer there is complicated because there's a bunch of marketing that conflates eBPF with service mesh. So you have to be able to step away from that. So what is eBPF? eBPF is basically the ability to run a very limited virtual machine within the kernel, specifically for network traffic. So it gives you a way of adding, doing some limited amount of network stuff directly in the kernel rather than in user space, which means it's much faster, right? So the way that it works with the service mesh is, at least, is that eBPF is going to handle the layer 4 stuff, and then service mesh will handle layer 5 through 7 or whatever, you know. So that model is a little outdated, frankly. But yes, so you can certainly use it with eBPF, and we have a blog post about using Linkerd with Cilium and it all.
But it doesn't sound too recommended because it sounds like it's an outdated.
No, I mean, I think it's totally fine, right? If it speeds up the layer 4 stuff, then great, by all means, do that. eBPF is very limited and you can't, it runs in the kernel, so they have to be very restrictive to what they allow you to do. So you can't really do string manipulation and stuff like that. So you can't do TLS termination in eBPF. So you have to rely on something in layer 7 anyways.
Right. So, and that's a good one to kind of, because I've got another question from Rama here as well. What facts do you consider the best service mesh to begin with? Because obviously there's, because I think to your point, there are different kinds of service meshes as well. And clearly Linkerd, one of the open source ones, is doing a great job at it as well. But there are all these marketing around, hey, ours is the best service mesh, ours is the best service mesh with, to your point, Nerdbake. What kind of things do you look for, or what do you recommend people should look for in a service mesh that they want to go for?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing is being very clear what you're trying to accomplish, right? Why are you adopting a service mesh? Is it just so that you can say you have a service mesh? Well, okay, that's not a great reason. And that's not going to give you a rubric by which you can make a good decision. If it's very clear to you, I need MTLS, or I really need cross-cluster communication, or I need the golden metrics for every application of my component, every component of my application in a uniform way, right? If you have a really clear goal, then I think you have a rubric by which you can make a decision. I'll say from the perspective of Linkerd, our focus has always been around simplicity. So we have prioritized operational simplicity over almost everything else and performance. So if what's important to you is it being really fast and really lightweight and being simple to operate, then I think Linkerd is a good choice. We're still catching up, honestly. We're still catching up on some of the features, but that race gets closer every release. So that's been our strategy.
Right. Well, cool. Thank you. Thanks for the question as well, Rama. So maybe one of the things that people talk about, and maybe this could be a straightforward answer in a cloud native context, is the whole scaling part. From a security perspective, we called out mutual TLS, and sounds like if you have a service mesh which does the rotation for you for mutual TLS, it makes the job a lot more easier, kind of like what you were talking about with Linkerd. Yeah. So it's the scaling component, and scaling and monitoring is kind of where I'm coming from, because we spoke about the implementation part. Now it's all the runtime. What are we really looking for in the runtime context? Because say we build an application, security architects are looking at it and then going, all right, what am I really monitoring here? Just that the mutual TLS doesn't fail, or is there a behavior thing? What are some of the things people should consider monitoring when they are working with a service mesh from a security?
Yeah, that's right. And that's a really good question, because for many people, what we find is you've just adopted Kubernetes, which is a lot. It's got a nice model. It's clear, it's composable, it's well designed, but it's a lot to learn. right? And then if you then have to, and it's a lot to operationalize. You need to understand how to monitor it and what are the failure cases and what do we do and what's our runbook. And then if you add the service mesh on top and it's just as complicated, then you've taken a step backwards, right? So we try and address this with Linkerd in a couple of ways. One is we try and make it smell and look and feel Kubernetes as much as possible. So to the extent that you have developed patterns around how do you operationalize Kubernetes, those should apply just as much, right? We run these control plane workloads. They sit in your in a namespace. They're pods. You can run them in HA modes. You can distribute three instances or five instances across different nodes. You can use all the Kubernetes. You use the standard Kubernetes things to monitor them. So we try not to do any special there at all. The other thing we do is, I said there's a control plane, there's a data plane, and the control plane is some machinery that sits in a namespace kind of off to the side. And the data plane is the proxies, right?
Yeah.
So the data plane is kind of constantly changing because whenever your application rolls or there's a new version or whatever, new proxies spin up and the old ones die and so on. We make it so that the data plane can function even if the control plane goes away. Right. So even if there's a network partition and something terrible happens, the data plane will still continue functioning. So monitoring the data plane is basically monitoring your application, right? Kubernetes gives you the health of your data plane is kind of the same as the health of your application. If a pod dies, whether it's an application dying or the proxy dying, which rarely happens, that's tantamount to pod failure. And Kubernetes has all these mechanisms for dealing with that. So what I would say is, yes, there's stuff you have to know about. You got to look at the resource consumption of the control plane. If that's growing suddenly, then you should send up a flare and go figure out what's going on. But there's nothing that is that dramatically special about operationalizing Linkerd with one or two asterisks. And I'll plug another thing that I wrote. We have a runbook. So if you search for Linkerd production runbook, we actually have this runbook. It's one version old. So I'm sorry, we have to update it. But it basically tells you, here's what we recommend you monitoring, and here's the threshold, and here's what we would do. And good luck. So we try and document that as possible.
Actually, that's a good point, because I think one thing that's not spoken about enough in the cloud native community is the amount of skill set you need in the team too, because there's a lot of open source options and people underestimate the amount of effort that would be required if they go down that path as well, where, hey, I'm going to go down open source, because this team needs to be technical. They need to be able to deploy it in a way that if that individual or if those two people who are working on it leave, can you still run it? Can you still manage it? Yep. So there's a whole scaling question as well here. So maybe first one being skill set, is there any thoughts on what kind of skill set people should have in their team if they go down the open source journey?
Yeah, I mean, you got to learn how to do all this stuff. Operating.
So high level, the team should be technical, I guess, where we're going with this, right? High level, that you understand this.
Yeah. I mean, there's no substitute. There's nothing really that we can do. You have to own your own availability, right? And if you're deploying an application on Kubernetes, whether it's a service mesh or not, you need to understand how that works. Now, typically what we'll see is, and I kind of alluded to this before, there's the developer teams writing the application, there's the platform teams. And some people believe that developers should be exposed to Kubernetes. I actually don't think they need to. I think if my model is, the platform team needs to really understand Kubernetes and the service mesh and whatever else, the CI system and whatever else. Developers don't necessarily need to be exposed to that. And it's kind of orthogonal to what they're doing anyway. So
I mean, I'm kind of with you on this one as well, because I feel it's not their responsibility to manage a platform. Plus, I think the years people have spent learning, say, Java, Node and all that, it just adds complexity to that, even though there's a whole role for full stack engineer. Probably too much to ask, I guess, for a developer to do, I would imagine.
I feel like the point of a platform is it gives you the stuff that you can run your code on, and you should know how to interact with it, but you shouldn't have to be an expert at any of that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of the same as if I were to use Word or PowerPoint, you should be able to use it, but it doesn't really mean you kind of need to know how the inner workings of it works. Right? You know, that's kind of where we're going with it. Right. And this kind of one of the reasons for me to ask that question is also because there are paid versions for this open source service versions as well. Yeah. Right? And actually, funny enough, I just realized Roxanne has a question on this as well. There are many open source or service mesh and some commercial ones. What extra capabilities a commercial one can give apart from support?
That's a great question. Roxanne's got all of the good questions. All right. So here is something that I have a strong opinion on. I have a very strong opinion because I've been thinking about this since the very beginning of Buoyant and the very beginning of Linkerd. And because I'm doing two things, right? I'm building an open source project, but we're also building a company behind it. And I want that relationship to be really good. And one kind of historical way you have that you have a company and an open source that project that have a relationship is you kind of have this feature withholding thing where you're saying, okay, open source has all these features, but these two or three things or these 20 things or whatever, that you actually, when you really get serious, when you really need to go to production, those aren't in the open source. We're going to withhold those, right? That you have to buy the commercial version, right? And Nginx is a classic example of this. Yeah. Nginx and then there's Nginx Plus. And Nginx works great, but if you need to monitor the request queue lengths or something, that's only in Nginx Plus or something like that. I don't know. And that's really difficult, right? It's difficult because you're continually kind of changing those features, right? Because that's an ever-shifting thing. And also it kind of pits you as a company against the open source community, right? The open source community wants this stuff and you're saying, no, I want you to be a community. I want you to be happy and I want you to propagate the project, but also I'm not going to give you the stuff. We kind of decided not to do that, right? And we decided instead, then the nature of software is changing, the nature of open source and kind of people's expectations for open source change too. So what we do at Buoyant is we say, Linkerd has all the features you need, right? It's got everything you want, right? We're never going to withhold anything. And instead, what we're going to do, and maybe there's one asterisk to that. There are things that, yeah, there's an asterisk to that because there are things that I think are bad that sometimes companies want. And I don't want them to go into the open source because they're bad, but companies sometimes really want them. And that stuff sometimes will only have a commercial solution. But by and large, the stuff that's good has to be in the open source. Okay, and then what we said is, what we're gonna sell you is we're gonna make it really easy to run Linkerd. We're gonna make it a managed service, basically, right? And so if you're running Linkerd and you want all the features and you wanna do it all yourself, then that's great. And if you want the features, but you don't wanna have to think about operating it and worry about being on call, then you can pay us money, right? And that division clarifies everything, makes everything very easy and allows us to be very wholehearted in our development of Linkerd, right? We don't have to worry about doing stuff and, well, should we keep this back for the commercial version or should, everything goes in open source, right? And it's very clear. And we have a very positive relationship with our community there.
Yeah, actually, because that's pretty interesting. I know about the feature withholding stuff as well. It's pretty interesting. So to your point then, to summarize, if you're looking at a service, probably see where the line for support is drawn, whether it's feature limitation or whether it's to your point, hey, you can use it, but from a managed service perspective, when you kind of switch over to a paid version, which kind of makes sense. Because I imagine at scale, this is even more complex between multiple clusters and as a platform team, if you have multiple platform teams and stuff growing as well, I imagine that's where the complexity comes in. So, but
it's complex. Yeah. And some organizations are totally capable of managing it and it's important for them to manage it. And it's important for them. They're customizing it. They have this very specific use case and that's totally fine, right? That's great. Yeah. And hopefully some of that stuff makes it back into the open source project and they contribute and we have this nice open source relationship. Other companies just don't care. Right there. I want Linkerd and I want the value prop, but I don't want to spend any of my brain on that. Right. So here, just make it work for me. And that's all.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you. And another question for Roxanne. She's on fire today with all these good questions. They're all good questions. I'll tell Roxanne to keep coming. Operation wise, there is an app team, there is a platform team, and there's a security team. Which team should operate service mesh?
Great question. Okay. So I have an opinion on this, which is I think the platform team needs to own the service mesh. I think the app team maybe needs to know that it's there, but by and large shouldn't have to really think about it. I think to the extent that they are forced to think about it, that's maybe a sign that something. But I think the security team needs to be heavily involved. So I think the platform team needs to own it and the security team needs to be involved because a lot of the value of the service mesh is in the security context, right? If the security team cares about zero trust, they need to understand, okay, where is that happening in the system and which communication is MTLS and which one is not and how is the sidecar helping us? And that stuff can't just be hidden away from them. So to answer Roxanne, platform team owns it, security team is involved and understands it, app team hopefully is decoupled.
Oh, so to your point about doing the deployment phase is when, or maybe to an on, for not, so because there'd be a monitoring component that you spoke about earlier, mm-hmm. that kind of is where security injection could be as well. And the other one being during the building processes as to what could be done on deploying this at scale across the board. That could be another place.
Yeah. So typically what will happen with the sidecar model, though, is the app code will write, the app team will write code. It'll get packaged up as containers. It'll be shipped to the cluster. And then once it's added, once it's actually deployed in the process of being deployed to the cluster, that's when the service mesh sidecar gets injected. So it's really not till the very last minute. We have this nice late runtime, you know. But you know, the security and if the service mesh goes down, the platform team who owns it is the one who needs to wake up and fix it, right?
That's right.
But the security team is going to care about things. Okay, we're relying on the fact that there's MTLS everywhere. How do we guarantee that a pod can never be created unless it has the sidecar proxy? How do we prove that, right? And that's kind of where the security team and platform team start intersecting. Right, the security team wants to know about those guarantees. platform team is in service to them.
Yeah. Also, right. So in Linkerd, would that be through the Linkerd control platform?
So how do you guarantee that the proxy is always part, which is what does the MTLS, is always Voidpod? Yeah. So in Linkerd, we give you the ability to turn on Kubernetes flag, basically, which said a pod cannot be created unless the proxy is injected into it. And so you can basically enforce, it's not on by default, but it's a very strict setting, but we give the ability to enforce that. So you're guaranteed if the pod is created, then it is doing MTLS. And if it can't for some reason, then it's not even allowed to be created.
Actually, that's a good one to kind of add to what we were talking about earlier from a security feature perspective, and people are thinking about how do they secure a service mesh, or mutual DLS obviously is one of them, but also ensuring that how do we limit any more new pods being created without mutual DLS being there? If that's definitely, I mean, I imagine most companies out there want to do encryption in transit.
Yeah.
So definitely makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the platform team is in service to the security team. They're just as much as they're in service to the app team. There are applications to be deployed and to run and be reliable. And if a machine dies, they shouldn't care. Right. And the security team needs to ensure that there's MTLS here, or we haven't even talked about policy. The app security team needs to ensure that a PCI service or a HIPAA service was not allowed to be called from a non-HIPAA service or whatever. There's other sorts of things that the security team really cares about.
And would compliance play a role in a service mesh context? Because I imagine Kubernetes obviously has a compliance umbrella sometimes that's put on it. What's the compliance umbrella for, or compliance? How would someone do compliance in service mesh?
Yeah, I mean, compliance is a pretty broad topic, but the areas that I'm familiar with are, okay, we've got a set of services that handle PCI data, and they have very different rules from the set of services that handle non-PCI data. And I need to make sure that there's no communication that happens between those two groups of services, except for these three things, which I've allowed.
Right? Yeah.
So that's a compliance rule. MTLS often is driven by a compliance or regulatory requirement. You know, sometimes it's driven by the security team being just saying, hey, we need encryption everywhere, which is good. And well, usually if the security, if it's driven by regulations and we just need encryption, right? If it's driven by the security team, usually the security team is a little smarter, right? And they're okay, we need workload identity, we need zero trust, and we need all that.
Right. Oh, but those words outside the service mesh, though, or can service mesh provide the workload identity? Can it do
that? Yeah, so that's what you get with MTLS. So we in Linkerd, we take the service account, which is this Kubernetes concept that's associated with a workload. That's what we use as the identity in the MTLS certificates. And that way, when you have service A talking to service B, it's not tied to IP addresses. It's not tied to anything in the network because you can't trust the network anymore, right? Tied to the actual workload identity as given by Kubernetes. And you can get fancier. There's fancier ways of doing that. You can get to hardware attestation and stuff like that. But MTLS is flexible enough that you can kind of provision identities. And the certificate then proves that you own that identity, but the semantics of that identity are up to you.
Right. Cool. Actually, that reminds me of a question that I should have asked in the beginning, but Istio kind of name comes up quite often with service mesh. What is it and how? Is it different to service mesh or is it the same thing?
No, it's also a service mesh. It's the one that Google made early on and had a lot of marketing and a lot of buzz. And it's
fundamentally, it's the same thing.
It's the same thing. Yeah, there's 12 of these things. Linkerd.
Yeah, that's right. Funny enough, we have a lot of these, but trying to figure out which one is probably the best one is dependent on a lot of things as well. So
it's a strong opinion, but it's a very self-serving opinion. Of course, I think Linkerd is the best, and that's the one you should use.
Yeah, and it's completely valid as well, because I think it's still very balanced to think about, just because there's a lot of marketing dollars behind something doesn't really mean it's maybe the best solution out there, I guess.
There's a lot of marketing and a lot of buzz.
Because I imagine the word marketing also does is actually directs the conversation in a very different way as well. Because instead of looking at, hey, these are some of the gaps, people just keep talking about, oh, look at how they're solving as well. So I can appreciate where that comes from. So I've got a question for Rama as well. What are challenges or areas you keep an eye once we have successfully implemented a service mesh? Is it all green after that? It's the same as the monitoring one, but yeah, I'll let you answer.
Yeah, gosh, I don't know. Once you've got the service mesh in there, you're done. You can just go home.
Job well done.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's so much more. A service mesh is just one component, right? If you are running an application, right, or if you're building a platform for your app team and you need that application to be reliable, and you need to be secure, and you need to be performant, and you need to, you know, be flexible enough that you can ship code 12 times a day or 100 times a day. There's a lot to that. And Service Mesh can solve one tiny piece of that, and Kubernetes can solve maybe a slightly bigger piece, but there's a lot more. So
actually, to your point, it's worth pointing out. I know we've been talking about Service Mesh, but Service Mesh is just one component of an application that we'll be building. To your point, it's kind of like maybe if I were to switch it back to the traditional conversation which we were talking about earlier, where it's similar to network security. Network is just the underlying bed or platform where you can use that to communicate, but not the actual application.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you got to worry about CI/CD. You got to worry about what open source libraries are we using, and do they have any vulnerabilities? And you have to worry about kind of dependency management. There's a lot going in here.
But from a service mesh perspective, at least the ones that he spoke about so far, at least that component could be worked off from that.
Yeah, I mean, once you deploy it, you got to monitor it. You got to operationalize it, all that good stuff. You got to keep up to date with updates and stuff.
Yeah.
Any other software. And I think the one thing, software is a process, right? It's not a static thing anymore. We're long past the days of you ship a CD and then or a floppy and you put the floppy in, now you've got the software and you're done, right? Now everything is a process. Now everything is keeping up to date and other dependencies are changing. And that means we all get to keep our jobs, which is nice, but also means that life is complicated.
Yeah, fair enough. Hopefully that answers your question, Rama. Thanks for that, man. And got just a few comments from him as well. Again, awesome discussion and insight. Thank you. Mm-hmm. One more comment from Roxanne. It's interesting we have teams that their environment only works with one type of service mesh, that is console. Is that true? From a security perspective, we love service rationalization and hate it when we end up with multiple services that does almost the same thing.
Yeah, it's complicated. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely situations where only one service mesh would work. Linkerd, for example, is very Kubernetes specific. So if you're not running on Kubernetes, then we can't help you. And at least not yet. On the roadmap is this other stuff to extend beyond Kubernetes. But today, that's kind of where you are. I think console is a little more generic than that. So that might be the situation they're in.
Ah, right. Okay. So that's also interesting. To your point, then, when you're picking up a service mesh, you could potentially be in an environment where there could be multiple types of service mesh running as well.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. And in fact, we regularly see this. So we'll regularly see, especially for larger organizations, they've adopted, one team adopted this service mesh, and then another one adopted this one, and then another one adopted this one. And maybe the first one doesn't theirs anymore, and they're thinking about switching the second one, and it's always messy.
Okay, well, that's a good note to kind of talk about. What does maturity look for? Probably the last question for this as well. What does maturity look for service mesh then? When people are thinking, all right, I've heard William say, great, I want to do something about this. And they're looking from a scaling, from a maturity perspective. What's level one and maybe what's level five, I guess?
You mean the maturity of the projects?
Yeah, that's right. When you're deploying service mesh, I guess to your point, you could start with maybe just having a service mesh in the first go, I guess. But then mutual TLS enforcing, I guess, Kubernetes being the only source.
I see. Okay, so there's kind of two axes to this. There's how mature are the projects themselves, and then there's how mature is my adoption, right?
Yeah.
I'm very happy to say that. So Linkerd is a CNCF project, and the CNCF has these different levels of kind of maturity, and Linkerd is at the topmost level as of last summer. We're in the graduation tier. So we're out there with Kubernetes and Prometheus and kind of all these big pillars of the open source community. So that Linkerd itself is very mature. Right now, what about your adoption of a service mesh? Yeah, level one is deploying it, right? Deploying it on a dev cluster, and then there's deploying it and staging. And then once you get to the point where you're in, I'd say real maturity comes when you understand the failure models. So for Linkerd, we've got the easy mode of deploying, and then we've got HA mode, right? And HA mode means you're going to run multiple replicas, and we're going to spread them across different machines, and you can withstand all sorts of failures. I think so that's one sign of maturity. I think another sign of maturity is the use of features, right? So you can install Linkerd and you get a bunch of stuff out of the box without having to do anything, right? You get metrics, amazing metrics. You don't have to do anything. You just get them, right? And then there's some, are you doing anything with those metrics? Are you consuming them? Are you alerting on service health and things like that? But then we also have some more advanced features that are kind of opt-in, things like policy, right? So I only want service A to be able to talk to service B, and service C is not allowed to talk to service B. You can enforce it, but you have to build up those policies, right? So that's another sign of maturity is, are you making use of that full feature set?
Interesting. Awesome. That was really awesome to kind of have all the questions answered from team over here as well. Thank you, Roxanne and Rama, and everyone else who joined us for the live stream. And where can people find you, William, for if they want to connect and maybe have follow-up questions on service mesh?
I'm on Twitter, WM, so just... you look for at WM, that's me. Linkerd is spelled LINKERD. So the D is spelled separately. And you can find that on Twitter and linkerd.io. And then Buoyant, of course, you can find on the web. on the web. .io is B-U-O-Y-A-N-T. So make sure the U goes before.
And I'll put those links on the show notes for the web on the website as well, so people can get to that as well. But I really wanted to say thank you for spending the time with us. I learned so much. So thank you so much for doing this. And I can't wait to have you again some Monday. And I think it'll be pretty awesome to hopefully, maybe, I don't know if you're attending the KubeCon next month, but if you are, probably you just say hello there as well.
I will be there. I'll be in Valencia. We'll have a booth and everything. So yeah, if you're there, yeah. And thank you for having me. This has been a blast.
Well, it's a pleasure myself as well. So thank you so much for your time. And thank you for the audience for tuning in and asking all those questions as well, especially Roxanne and Rama as well. So thanks so much, everyone. We'll see you next week with another episode of Cloud Native Security. But until then, stay safe. Talk to you soon. Peace. Thank you for listening to that episode of Cloud Security Podcast. If you found some new information from that episode, we would appreciate if you share it with others. Share it with us as well if you have any good feedback or good learnings from the episode. We are on all your favorite podcast platforms. If you don't find us there, you can always go on our website, www.cloudsecuritypodcast.tv, to listen to the latest episode. We appreciate your support in helping us grow. It helps us bring more guests. It helps us support the channel. So really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time, and talk to you on the next episode.